So this whole rambling beginning does lead me into one of the first things that jumped out at me in your book. And it's from the first chapter, and I'm going to quote it, if that's all right.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was born into these currents. I did not create or invent them, and I make no claims to objectivity. I find the whole idea that we can transcend our experiences and take a totally unbiased look at the world to be totally ridiculous, yet that's what many historians and academics claim to do. This is also what the media claims to do.
Yeah.
Could you just talk about this distinction between objectivity and subjectivity and the power dynamics of it?
Yeah, I mean, well, exactly. People who have the power to name and control other people's perception, who have the power of the nation state and other institutions of coercion and violence, can present themselves for preservation of their power as being objective. We are fair. There is no way, as an English Etonian, you can possibly view the world through the eyes of a Bangladeshi woman, which is what you're saying. When you're saying I'm being objective, no, the best thing we can, and it's a way of excluding other biases. So if you pretend that your opinion is not biased, there is no need for other biases to be tabled, because, you know, I'm speaking on behalf of everyone, I'm objective.
Yeah.
In reality, a fairer society, a more democratic society, a better society, is a society with more biases tabled at once, rather than a society with a bunch of the most privileged people saying, oh no, we're completely objective. The language alone you speak biases you towards certain methods of thinking, certain methods of conception. So if you think of, say, Maori identity versus British identity, you could be half Maori and half white, and you're still Maori, because Maori identity is conceived of through lineage, not through blood quantum. You don't have to have two fully blooded Maori parents. In fact, when the Maori I speak to here, one thing they tell me is the amount white folks say to them, oh, but there aren't that many full blooded Maori left. It matters more to them than it does to Maori, in the sense of, because Maori identity is conceived of through lineage. I am so-and-so's grandson. I speak this such-and-such language. I come from such-and-such area. These are my people. So concepts of identity, concepts of belonging, concepts of all of this is embedded in our culture, in the language we speak, in our upbringing. Objectivity is, you can try and be fair. That's the best you can do. The idea you can be unbiased. I went to a talk the other day actually with a journalist from New Zealand. I believe he was a Kiwi. And he said exactly that, and then I challenged him. Because a sentence later, he said that the jury system has worked perfectly for 200 years. And I said, to what extent do you think the Maori or Australian Aborigines or Black Americans would think that the jury system has worked perfectly for 200 years? But you just said 2 minutes ago, you're completely not biased. But that is an unbelievably biased statement you've just made. And people don't even realise it. So I think it's better for people to say, no, own your own bullshit.
And in terms of owning your own bullshit, is it about actually tabling who you are, what you know?
100%. I am a man. I am able-bodied. I'm grew up being good at sports. I'm light-skinned. All of that makes a difference to my experience of the world. If I was jet black, I might have got insulted and called names or names that I wouldn't have experienced because I'm of lighter skin, etc.
Like, in terms of attempting to be truthful, which is what everybody says that is, right? Objectivity, neutrality, being truthful.
Yes, it's nonsense. I'll give you an example. I'm a mostly vegan. I occasionally eat cheese, but I've been 99% plant-based for 15 years almost, right? This sort of arrogance of the sort of Western vegan community that think they're like saving the world because they don't eat meat, and they think it makes them morally superior to everybody else.
That's a great
Even
example.
Though they've got the same sort of Colton-filled iPhone that everyone else has, they travel all around the world consuming diesel fuel. Jamaican Rastafarians have managed to be vegetarian for 100 years without believing that they're morally superior to everybody else. There are a few 100 million vegetarians in India that don't seem to believe that they're morally superior to everyone else. All of a sudden, a few middle-class people in the West kind of stop eating meat, and they think the whole world should sort of bow before their innate morality. And even as someone who doesn't eat meat, it irritates the hell out of me. Like, you're not morally superior just because you don't eat lambi.
Like, but also because it's like they feel like they've suddenly discovered what's going to save the world, when people have been doing that since forever.
I mean, there are people who've not eaten meat in India for thousands of years. And so I think in terms of owning your own bullshit, it's we all are taught to believe the problem is out there. It's other people. And I think some people who listen to me mistake me for one of those people who thinks I'm morally superior. No, most of my music and a lot of my philosophy is about the bad shit that exists in the world also exists inside me, and I'm battling that inside myself every day. And I think the tendency among people to just want to feel that they're great and other people are bad and that's the end of it, blinds them to their own bias often.
A Guide to Denial, that chapter was great. With the great Charles Mills quote, I particularly enjoyed that you picked apart the ridiculousness of each state. Why is it that the people who say these things don't get that they sound incredibly misinformed?
I think they do. I think that a lot of white folks' defensive reactions to discussions about race are revealing in and of themselves. So, for example, when we talk about transatlantic slavery in Britain, British people do two things. On the one hand, they say, get over it, it was all in the past. Then in the same breath, maybe one sentence later, they say, but we were the first to abolish it. Also, we should remember that Britain were the good guys. We shouldn't remember the actual slavery. No one in England is ever going to say we should abolish Remembrance Day. You know, it's all in the past. Forget it. We didn't fight in that war. What they're really saying is they believe their ancestors are worthy of remembrance and my ancestors are not. And so they do understand. Part of the irrational reactions show that they understand, because they react irrationally to some historic discussions and not to others. It's not like they want to do away with the concept of history completely. But there's rational reason. If I look bad, even if I haven't committed a crime personally, the crime has been committed in my name. I'm not going to want to highlight and bring attention to that necessarily. And so I think I don't pay much. Remember, because my mother is white, I know that white people discuss race just as much as everybody else, just not in earshot of everyone else all the time. And so I don't pay much attention to a lot of the silly kind of denialist, derailing, I believe they call it gaslighting online. I don't pay much attention to any of that crap because I understand what's going on.
So how much time actually should be spent on responding to those sort of statements? Isn't that like the first step of tackling white supremacy?
Well, yes and no. I think that the balance of power in the world is shifting, whatever anyone wants to do about it. And the everyday racism comes out of the fact that Western nation states for the last few hundred years have had the power to do whatever they like, basically. We're entering an era in which there is a multipolar world emerging, in which there are going to be several poles of power: China, India, Russia, the United States primarily. Navigating that world is going to be quite a different world from the world of 100 years ago, where Europe owned virtually the entire world. So, for example, until recently, Australia and New Zealand had the power to ban Chinese people from coming to the country. Try doing that today. Good luck. How are you going to do that when your economy is dependent on trade with China? And so Western superiority and the attendant racial philosophies that have gone with it are being undone every day by the changing of world power.
We do have a foreign buyers ban.
What?
A foreign buyers ban.
Which is what? Buying houses?
Nobody from overseas is allowed to buy houses.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, lots of countries have that. But that also means white people from overseas can't buy property.
Yeah.
Or not.
Yeah.
Is there a loophole for Russians? Is there a loophole for English people? It's a genuine question.
I think that the rhetoric behind that entire campaign to get that ban through, it was very heavily premised on
the Chinese.
Chinese sounding names was literally a quote by one of our politicians, who's now the Minister for Housing.
Yeah. But this is one of the fascinating things about Western societies. They believe in the free market and democracy so long as it preserves white power. The moment that the free market or democracy, so you'll see as white folks start to become minorities, democracy will not prevail. I'm not going to put myself in a position where the Maori can decide who gets into parliament. Do you see what I mean? So you'll see how much actually these ideas were coded in what Charles Mills calls a racial contract.
Yeah.
That it was democracy and free markets were fine between Europeans and European elites. Free markets, the moment Chinese people have more money than we do, don't sound so interesting anymore, because, you know, it ends up with the Chinese owning half of Auckland. But it was fine for British people to own half of Hong Kong. Do you see what I mean? I mean, it cuts both ways, B.
Yeah.
So a lot of these tools are preservations for power.
There's been a very specific and very structured agenda of ensuring the invisibility of whiteness, and as this begins to be deconstructed, or what you've called the decline of whiteness, we're seeing huge amounts of backlash on a very broad spectrum, from harmless ignorance to intentional violence. Can you talk a bit about that whiteness, why it's necessary to be deconstructed, and why there's a backlash?
I think it's really a dangerous... The cultivated ignorance is really dangerous, not actually just for black and brown people. As I point out in the book, the greatest blow to Western prosperity, to Western power, to white life, was the Nazis. Was white supremacy taken to its logical end conclusion? And by logical, I do not mean good. I just mean if you believe in innate biological inferiority and superiority, that's where you end up. The Nazis are often presented as if they were sort of an aberration, when in fact they emerged out of the colonial... I mean, they'd already committed genocide in Africa. Many of the senior members of what went on to become the Nazi Party had been in Namibia when they exterminated much of the Herero and Nama people. The Nazi laws to govern the Jews were based on American or inspired by American Jim Crow laws. So they were part of the larger articulation of imperialism and white superiority. As it becomes obvious, as the world continues to change, that this was all one big myth, that no group of people is superior to anyone else intellectually, that there have been large periods of human history. I mean, for the first 17 centuries of the last 20, China and India were richer than Western Europe anyway. So we're actually returning to normal. Lots of people who've been brought up with these myths, I find it very difficult to psychologically adjust. And I would argue actually that in many ways, even though there's legitimate fear of kind of resurgent, nascent white supremacist movements, actually lots of people who should be concerned about this should be white folks themselves. This is not about doing charity for us. This is about your children adjusting to a world in which an Indian woman is probably going to be their boss. And how are they going to cope with that? If we're in a world when Indian women are putting rockets on Mars and we believe in meritocracy, then an Indian woman who can put a rocket on Mars clearly deserves to be my boss if I'm a scientist, right? If you live in a world where you believe being a man or being a white man or any of that means that you're entitled to anything, you're in for one hell of a shock. I mean, even in Iran, 70% of the students in science and engineering are women. That's the world we live in now. And lots of men are finding it really, really difficult to adjust and to compete. They talk about how everyone else is a snowflake, everybody else is weak, everyone else... For the first time in your life, you have to compete without the state ensuring your place in society over and above everyone, and you don't like the taste of it. And that resentment is very, very dangerous. We're seeing that a lot in the UK, we're seeing it here. And it's mixed up, of course, with legitimate economic concerns. It's mixed up with legitimate history of class. I'm not saying it's all just about that, but I'm saying there is definitely a current of, what does it say about me if my boss is an Indian woman? That's how some people feel.
You could also say snowflake seems like a really shitty comeback though, also.
Well, I mean, nobody calls me a snowflake. I'm sort of insulated from some of that stuff. Because even though I use, broadly speaking, academic language, I'm from what I'm from. I mean, the first time I saw someone get cut up, I was 12. You can't call me a snowflake if you've never been exposed to violence in real life. One of the reasons I'm always polite to people is because I understand that words have consequences, much more than anyone who's had a nice, and I'm not knocking anyone who had a nice liberal upbringing, whose parents were academics, good for you. But I am not under the illusion that words don't have consequences, because I've seen lots of people get their heads split in half for talking shit. And so the snowflake thing doesn't really work with me. I believe that trying to build a society in which more people have a stake and less people are desperate is actually enlightened self-interest, which capitalists claim they believe in. A society with more desperate people is inherently a more dangerous society. I've seen what desperate people do. I grew up with some people that were desperate. It's not pretty. But yeah, snowflake. Anyone that comes back, the great Indian physicist C.K. Raju says, anyone that comes back with slogans or adjectives, they're proving they have no argument. When people don't come back with facts, when they don't say you're factually incorrect because X, Y, Z, when they come back with an adjective, they're admitting that they haven't got no argument.
So you've got this sort of building of white resentment, yeah, along with white victimization, which I put in, yeah, quotes. And then you've also got the pivot to Asia and Trump's escalations of tensions with Iran. Like, in terms of a sort of global, the rise of white supremacy, which has actually been around forever, what are we expecting over the next sort of...
I don't know. I would love to be able to have a crystal ball and predict the future. I don't know. I think one thing I will say about, say, Iran, one of the reasons we're given the sort of phrase Muslim, as if it explains that whole region of the world, is to sort of give the impression that the Iranians are equally bad as the Saudis. A country in which there's a parliament, a country in which women have some at least political voice. Not romanticising Iran, I know there are some really regressive and horrible things going on in Iran too, but we're giving this sort of people who can understand the difference between New Zealand and America, even though they're both Western polities, even though they're both English speaking, understand that the human rights abuses in the two are not remotely comparable, would like to give us the impression that the Saudis, who are our mates, are virtually no different from the Iranians, and therefore our relationship with the Saudis is somehow legitimate. That's what I will say in that context. But what we're going to see in the future, who knows, mate? Who knows? I've, the whole conclusion of the book is asking questions about the future,
yeah,
rather than making definitive statements about what's going to happen.
You moved then into talking about your schooling years, which, as you often say, were incredibly formative in regards to understanding racialized treatment, but also how you viewed education. And you discuss schools as a place that reinforced societal norms. In many ways, the system could set up specific children on a direct path to prison. Would you be able to speak more about that?
Yeah, I mean, so in my own experience, I was put in a special needs group for kids who didn't speak English. Luckily for me, I had a mum who was militant, and I went to Pan-African Saturday School when I got pulled out of that group. If I didn't have that support network and I stayed in that group for a year and completely just began to hate education and then went on, followed that path, misbehaved, get expelled, go prison, you know, and this is very common, especially actually for black boys who are a little too bright for their own good. This kind of taking people out of mainstream schooling and putting them in special needs groups, what used to be called schools for the educationally subnormal, entirely common. And again, this isn't just about race, it's also about class. In a hierarchical society like Britain, lots of poor white kids have heard, that's no job for the son of a plumber. That's no aspiration for the son of a bricklayer. Britain is committed to reproducing, broadly speaking, social inequalities at what I would call manageable levels. And in that context is where children are functionally undereducated, to funnel them into lower sections of the economy.
Another thing that you pointed out in that chapter was when there was evidence that shows that that system wasn't working, but that evidence didn't transform into policy change. We know that policy change doesn't happen quickly, if it happens at all. So how do we change that?
Community self-education, which is what I was lucky to be beneficiary of. It shouldn't take, for in the context of Britain, for black parents to have to educate their kids on the weekend too, talking often about working class black parents. You pay your taxes, the school should deal with them properly. There might be grounds for a class action lawsuit against the British education system in general. Who knows?
People should,
potentially.
It's massive.
Potentially. I mean, I'm not saying I'm going to do it or I can do it. I'm saying if there is evidence. So, for example, Bristol and Warwick University did two studies where they looked at data from every single secondary school in Britain, and they found that black children with the exact same previous academic performance were 30% less likely to be entered for higher tier GCSE. They also found that the gap between a student's measured intelligence in empirical testing and the way teachers assess them in the classroom was biggest for black students of any group. Massive. So what I'm saying is the data is there now. If the Department of Education and other institutions don't change, there could be grounds for some sort of organised action in what format, I don't know. That'll be left to other people.
People are well and truly affected by historical propaganda. That structured agenda, which has put one group of people above many others for no reason other than socially constructed ideas, people still believe in this because they've been led to do so and then have also benefited from it. Where does social responsibility stop and personal responsibility begin?
I don't know.
How does it begin?
I don't know. I mean, do you have a duty to be an informed citizen? Is it enough to just live your own life, take care of your own family? Life is tough. It's completely understandable. Lots of people just head down, work, home, bills, family, kids. Between all of that, you know, lots of people don't have the luxury of reading books and philosophizing and engaging with social issues and all that sort of stuff. So there's in some sense in which the material challenge of being a human being occupies 90% of your time. But you know, you want to live in a world that is safer for your children. By definition, you want a world that is safer for other people's children, then, don't you? Which means whether we like it or not, engaging in some of these issues, I would argue.
That life that you just described, instead of work, home, bills, raising children, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Is that not somewhat linked, and I don't have obvious stats on this, but I mean, we have such high rates of depression here, especially in that capitalist-driven society.
Yeah.
Aren't we, I guess like you say, that personal responsibility isn't probably always an immediately obvious thing.
Yeah. I mean, there are 84 men a week commit suicide in Britain. It's one of the richest, most prosperous, stable countries ever to exist. Yet almost 100 men a week kill themselves. I would argue, yeah, it's very much rooted in that sort of treadmill, rat race, all that sort of stuff. Yeah, it's very much rooted in that, I think.
I want to touch on your music too. And I just want to say, my friend Rob, he grew up in London and Essex. and yeah. I showed him your flyer in the booth, and he said it's the best freestyle he's ever heard, so thanks, bruv.
Big him up for me.
In terms of your relationship with the mainstream, I suppose we can call it here, in terms of rap, my boyfriend only listens to grime, really, and music that doesn't succumb to pressures of mainstream or pop, in the sense that one doesn't objectify women's bodies, for example. So for the purposes of this question, I'm distinguishing between American mainstream pop culture and the alternative stuff, and only alternative because it doesn't get played on the major platforms, right? Which is an issue in itself. So he listens to the likes of you, Loki, Logic, People's Army, and so on. Him and I have had some discussions or arguments about Beyonce and Kendrick Lamar, for example, being in the mainstream, and he wanted to ask what you think about American pop culture and music, and whether it's undoing what you and grime on a larger scale try to do.
No, not really. I don't. I think it is what it is. I mean, Kendrick is definitely not a good example. Kendrick, you know, is I think someone who has been successful in spite of making incredible, brilliant, musical, politically challenging, you know, music. I think now he's successful, people will criticise him. But if he was still underground, it's almost like being underground gives you more credibility. I don't think there's anything wrong with people being pop stars based on the merit of their music. Bob Marley was a pop star. Jimi Hendrix was a pop star. Nina Simone was a pop star. Sam Cooke was a pop star. Otis Redding was a pop star. So I don't mind people saying, Stevie Wonder. People can sell millions of records and still be credible. If I don't like their music, I don't like their music. I think there's a lot of focus on artists rather than on the mechanisms around them. Artists are where they are, and it says something about us as a society, not just about them as an individual artist. You know, if Get Rich or Die Trying sells 11 million records, that says something about society. There is a market for a particular type of behaviour, for a particular type of set of stereotypes. A market driven actually predominantly by middle class white consumers, like, which is what it is, because obviously in the West anyway, most consumers are middle class and white anyway, of anything, conscious hip hop or negative hip hop. So I think it's a wider discussion than just the artist, but I think it's easy to take shots at people. You don't know what personal dilemmas and personal demons people are battling with, and so because I've got older and hopefully a little bit wiser, I've tried to be a little less judgmental. Because I've seen even in my own life, the little bit of quote-unquote success I now appear to have, the way it's changed. I haven't changed what I'm saying. I'm saying the same stuff I've been saying since 2004. But the way just more people listening has upset other people, even people who you would think will support me. Because people just are jealous and people are resentful, and I don't think it matters what you do or how much you keep your... There are people who've got an issue with Loki, not because of anything he says. Because he's successful, and their perception of what success is what it is. So I think people always find a reason to take issue. That said, there are legitimate critiques of mainstream US popular culture. That's I'm not denying that. I mean, Hillary Clinton called hip hop a chess piece. Yeah, so there's an admission there that there's an understanding in which of the way in which this promotes American interests. But hey. It's all very complex. Yeah. You don't know what private pressures lots of these people are under, is
that
I'm saying.
That's true. Do you think, though, again, going back to the, I suppose, personal responsibility, do you think that listeners or audiences should be more sort of aware of not only the complexity, but that monopoly?
They should be aware, yeah. But, I mean, maybe people just prefer to listen to music that degrades women and is about Cristal and
you're very generous.
No, but maybe they do. I mean, if people are selling millions of records, you know, consumer behaviour, you could say people are coerced into it, advertising budgets, all of this sort of stuff. Yeah, I'm sure that's partly true. I'm sure also partly there is an appetite for bullshit. Someone said, Carl Sagan's series Cosmos had one series. Keeping Up with the Kardashians is on series 15 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Maybe that's who we are as a species.
Okay.
I wish it wasn't, but maybe that's who we are.
Okay. I was going to ask you Logic's question. Why don't people recognise Eve in the same way they recognise Christmas, and how come tunes like Spectator don't get a lot more listeners?
Well, people do recognise Eve the same way they recognise Christmas. It just depends where you are in the world. I don't know what the relationship is in, and that goes for all religious festivals. I mean, Diwali, and I've been in India when Diwali's on. It's a big deal. So part of that's about culture. I mean, I think radio with my own self, mainstream radio, even the idea of something being radio friendly, what does that mean? There's an assumed norm about what is friendly to the radio, and a lot of that is ceasing to exist because of YouTube and Spotify and all of these new ways of consuming music. I mean, that people have got much more choice than they ever had before. However, when you look at the most streamed artists in the world, there's still artists that are mainstream big, that are on major labels, that are on the radio, etc. So
I have something else, but you say in the book that you wish there was a greater range of voices making their way into mainstream popular culture.
Yeah.
So is that our solution to the problem, or that solution to the problem?
No, I wouldn't say it's the solution, but it's part of... People have to be... To believe bullshit, people have to be lied to all the time. I wouldn't say all people, but I'd say at least half people, their minds can be changed with good, regular interruptions of reasoned argument. Reasoned, fact-based argument. I do genuinely believe that. So that's why certain voices generally have tended to be excluded. As the mainstream media is losing its grip and losing its dominance, more and more radical voices are having to be invited into the mainstream, because otherwise they'll just go on YouTube. You know, if you're the BBC, for years I was never on telly. I built a certain platform on YouTube and online, and then eventually, you know, the news don't stop calling and everything else. But it took that online success for mainstream media to acknowledge me. I think that there's a negotiation going on, and I think that it does matter what voices make their way into the mainstream.
You address in the book actually not using the N-word in your music.
Yeah.
And the quote is, "No truly self-loving people celebrate their own death, especially not for the entertainment of the primary beneficiaries of that death." And it's not my position to go into the sort of complexities of the word itself, but I wanted to sort of take that quote and say that in explaining, can you not extend that to say more generally about a lot of mainstream pop, not only music, but I suppose beyond that, in terms of maybe even creatives being co-opted by that system, or anybody really being encouraged to cater for a much larger audience, could you not sort of apply...
No, not really. I mean, someone, I don't know, singing opera because they think it will appeal to upper class French people is not the same. I mean, it's not the same as... There's some logic, perverse logic, that in the United States of America, a country that had apartheid for longer than any other society, that the, and is a racial capitalist society, the celebration of black death is a viable product in the marketplace. And so I suppose that's what I'm talking about. I'm not even judging it. I'm a hypocrite, as I go on to say. I love a lot of gangster rap music, but I do wonder what it says about me. And I wonder how future generations will look back and say, "Right, like black people used to listen to music saying, 'Kill that nigga, that nigga ain't shit, blah blah.'" But in the future, our descendants may look back and think, "What the hell was we doing? How could we ever have thought that was no more acceptable?"
I wanted to talk a bit about the terror attacks.
Yeah.
But before that, you talk in the book a lot throughout about different contexts around the world, and you talk about how you received in terms of your skin colour in different contexts. So how do you think your copable, your main message or ideas and issues that you discuss, how are they received by non-Western people of colour? What is your relationship to people in those contexts, especially because most of yours, I mean, all your music's in English and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked in many countries in Africa and Asia doing educational stuff, and it seems that, ironically, I think a couple of things go on. Obviously, there's an understanding of colonialism, but the context is different in that race is not always the defining line of oppression in Nigeria. The ruling class are black. Obviously, Nigerians understand the history of colonialism and the way in which Western capital and foreign capital in general still determines their day-to-day existence. But ultimately, the police are black, the army's black, the president's black, there isn't the same ethnic identity is more the bone of tension and cleavage in Nigeria or in Zimbabwe than racial difference. But broadly speaking, from the time I've spent lecturing or teaching or working in the Africa and the Caribbean and South Asia, there seems to be a lot of resonances and a lot of understanding from where I'm trying to come from.
So moving to New Zealand, I guess just firstly, what was your response to the attacks?
Responds, I don't really know. I mean, obviously the most obvious empathy and solidarity with the victims. Was I a little bit surprised it was in New Zealand? Perhaps. Not as surprised as maybe other people were. I don't think any society is immune to these kinds of psychotic behaviour. But then the sort of, I didn't follow this story as much as some of the other ones, maybe because I was travelling or whatever else. But I wonder to what extent, I'd like to do a study of this one, because I did it more with Dylan, well, I don't even like saying their name, but with other white supremacist terrorists, the sort of lost little boy narrative and the sort of bad individual versus, of course, when it's a Islamic fundamentalist, the whole Muslim world is in charge and is to blame. And it's sort of, even it's revealing that even though there haven't been any Muslim-inspired terrorist attacks in New Zealand, that in someone's mind, the Muslims that live in New Zealand, who've lived there peacefully, who've integrated into the society, who have not killed anybody, are responsible for what other Muslims in other places have done at other times. And so even that is revealing that in a society in which there isn't a history of Islamic-inspired terrorist attacks, that that could still happen here. And that's what you get when you get collective blame.
Our Prime Minister called it an unprecedented act of violence, which in terms of the current climate of global terrorism and Islamophobia, it is. But in terms of white supremacy, it's not unprecedented on this land. In fact, the nation itself was founded on extreme acts of violence. So I sort of want to talk about historical amnesia, and we could say omissions or a deliberate effort for the society to not know its own history. Even today, the government has not made teaching about our New Zealand land wars as like a compulsory part of the curriculum. So why do words, sentences, and therefore stories matter?
Well, it comes back to the very opening of the interview when you talk about bias. There are just inherent biases that we're taught, inherent things we're taught to ignore or not acknowledge or not, oh, that's different, that was then, or so. And so you use a word like unprecedented. It's perhaps not the right choice of words. Do you know what I mean? But it's complicated. You live in a prosperous social democratic society, and you can, especially if you're not Maori, sort of the events of 200 years ago are probably not at the forefront of your mind. But if they're affecting your day-to-day reality today, if they're affecting the way the police deal with you, if they're affecting the likelihood that your kids will go to prison, and of course those events seem all the more current and all the more relevant. And it's not they're not affecting you. In fact, if you're the, if you've got the upside of those events for 200 years ago, then it is in your interest to not see them and ignore them.
I guess just briefly on that, this whole campaign happened afterward of saying they are us. That was something that the Prime Minister had said. Do you think that that is automatically an othering? It's still a process of othering, as in
the victims,
we grieve,
mean?
For you, they are us.
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? Because you're damned if you do, damned if you don't in this case. You know, when everyone said, you know, we are France, or, you know, hearts to Paris, or everyone turned their memes to the French flag, everyone pointed out, oh, well, you don't do this when this happens in Baghdad or Syria. Yeah. But then if you do that, people will say, well, but hold on a minute, you're not really a Syrian. You're a white, rich white Westerner. So this is a difficult thing to negotiate. To what extent can you express genuine sympathy and solidarity with communities that you clearly are not? You clearly, if you're clearly not a brown Muslim, you're not a brown Muslim. You don't walk around with that identity. You don't walk around with those challenges and that sense of collective blame. I suppose it depends where people are coming from. If people are sort of signalling their own virtue, and I do think that the phrase virtue signal has been overused, but it's more about that than genuine solidarity and sympathy, then it's nonsense. If it's a genuine sense of rah, like this is wrong. But yeah, it's a hard one to juggle. Because if they didn't do that, then everyone would say, well, why didn't they do it? Like they did it for Paris.
Yeah.
So it's, I do see that there is, call out culture can sometimes bring up its own, has its own illogic sometimes. And that is difficult. Stuff like cultural appropriation, I think sometimes things get overused or used in the wrong context. And it sort of undermines the solidity of the original argument sometimes.
I had this, a bit of a discussion just after the attacks with one of the hosts at the radio. He was sort of like saying that call-out culture basically was what led this racist to act violently.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's just ridiculous.
That's what I said.
Yeah, that's just ridiculous.
I was like,
so he went
really?
And killed 50 people because on social media...
He got, you know, he got told he was racist so many times that he got pushed into...
Isn't it miraculous that, you know, despite being told we're bad for basically three centuries. You know, how many black people in Britain have just gone and massacred random white people? I don't think it's ever occurred, not one time. Or in Jamaica, where black people have the entire, which is where my family's from, the entire army's black, the entire police force is black, the entire government's black. Why haven't the persecution of minorities in Jamaica, why weren't there any lynchings? You know, there's been the occasional attacks on Chinese shopkeepers. I don't want to romanticize Jamaica. There have been ethnic murders, but there isn't no Jamaican equivalent to the BNP, to the National Front, to the KKK, in a context where black people have all of the, where black people have a monopoly on violence. And that's not that black people are incapable of ethnic hatreds. Rwanda, the Nigerian Civil War, what's happened in South Africa now. It's, what is it about Jamaican society that most people don't even know that there's Jewish people in Jamaica? Because we haven't spent our time blaming them for everything that's wrong with Jamaican society. So when I tell people they're Jamaican Jews, people are shocked. When I tell people they're Syrian, Lebanese, Chinese, Scottish, Irish, Jamaicans, people are shocked. So the idea that you can get pushed to go and massacre women and children, by that logic, then, you know, Muslims have been pushed. Now people who block pop concerts are pushed. And I think there has to be a clear distinction between political violence, i.e., not that I'm condoning this, officer, but people targeting political targets, politicians, arms dealers, people who are involved in the politics of the thing they have an issue with, and people just blowing up random civilians. So if you look at historically, there's the long history of political violence, but the particular thing of just killing women and children, the idea that you can be pushed to do that because someone bullied you on social media or someone called you racist. I mean, I've been called nigger a significant amount of times in my life. I've not yet massacred any little white children as a result of it, because actually I'm in control of my mental faculties, and being called bad names doesn't make me want to go out and massacre random children who haven't called me anything, who haven't done anything, who were not even involved in the incident. I mean, it's the biggest fucking cop out ever. Part of my language. Sorry.
It's great. No, we can swim. I'll wrap it up soon, but yeah. I guess going back to your collective guilt or that sort of comment, after the attacks, it became very clear that a number of different Muslim groups, organisations, there'd been campaigns to try and get their concern heard by authorities in regards to very true and very real threats to their safety. The concerns were dismissed. People laughed at the idea that these extreme white supremacists had any means of causing real damage. So I just wondered what your thoughts were in sort of that process of dismissal of the other, but also in the idea that if it was flipped, right? If it was white people talking about Muslims,
Their concerns would be taken seriously, yeah.
Surveillance and that sort
of thing. Yeah, of course. In Britain, we have massive surveillance on the British Muslim community for that reason. It is what it is. The state cannot entirely denounce those concerns because it empathises with them. The state doesn't necessarily empathise with the concerns of Muslims, even if they are ostensibly citizens of the country.
Two more quotes, which obviously they're yours, so I don't need to read them, but we live in a world where literal card-carrying Nazis getting punched in the face or being refused platforms to speak garners more liberal outrage than 12-year-old Tamir Rice being executed on camera. Also, we live in a dangerously anti-intellectual age when we're encouraged to think all opinions are equal, but my opinion on what it takes to build a decent bridge is not equal to that of a structural engineer. So I guess sort of that first point, someone wants to know whether you thought debating racists on public platforms is a good idea, if it's useful or not, but also I guess just...
That is a really good question. I think there is a sense in which debating people and taking them seriously gives credence to their ideas. So deplatforming does work. There is a deliberate way in which the people have used the issue of deplatforming and pretend it's a free speech issue. Free speech is my right for the state to not arrest me, persecute me, torture me for things that I say. I am not owed a platform by the University of Auckland. I am not owed a platform by the New Zealand School of Tourism. I am not owed a platform by anyone. Any organisation can choose not to have me speak. They've not interfered with my free speech. What was done very cleverly is they conflated free platform with free speech as a way of saying the right is being silenced because they don't have a monopoly, as if the Daily Mail is being silenced. It's the most popular paper in the country. So we have to be clear on what those two issues are. people are allowed to deplatform whoever the hell they want. If I go to it, if I'm due to speak at a union, I'm deplatformed. I'm not going to go on Twitter and cry and say, oh, you're interfering with my free, you don't owe me a platform, so what, you cancel my speech? Boo-hoo, I'm not going to cry about it, because I, free speech is about my right to not be arrested by the state and not be persecuted by the state.
So then we spend all that time, though, having to kind of deconstruct those ideas.
Yeah, exactly. It's a great kind of tool of distraction. In terms of debating racists, it's difficult. If you don't debate them, their ideas are the ridiculousness of their ideas is allowed to fester and grow. If you do debate them, you are in a sense always at a disadvantage, because as a black person in particular, you're basically arguing your humanity. There will never be a situation in which a white person feels compelled to prove to a black American. So let's say a black American scientist comes along and says, look, I've been, you know, studying DNA and genetics for 50 years, and I believe that there is something that genetically just makes white people more evil. No white academic would feel compelled to even debate that, because obviously the black academic is not in a position of power to enforce that idea and give that idea mainstream credibility. By contrast, the idea that black people are intellectually inferior, bell curve, all this kind of stuff, has been given public credibility. So you end up debating whether or not you're a full human being.
Yeah.
So you lose anyway.
Yeah.
But I don't have a fixed view on it. And I don't condemn those that do debate, and I don't condemn those that do deplatform. I think both strategies can be effective depending on the individual context.
The anti-intellectual issue. We live in a dangerously anti-intellectual age. Why aren't we critical thinkers? Why aren't we raisers?
It's easier to not be, man. Offshore the thinking to someone else. Let someone else do the work. Let someone else be in charge. Let someone else do all the difficult stuff. I mean, we like to be lied to. It's great, man. It feels good. Just like we like hating people sometimes.
Okay. That's all you have to say?
Yeah.
We've talked heaps about issues, and I sort of want to touch on your solutions, I suppose. Not that you have all the answers in the world,
yeah.
but is there hope?
Reading, discussion, organisation, love. There is what they call in sociology the contact hypothesis. Get to know other people.
Mm.
You know, no matter what, you know, that stuff actually does work. Like, there was a fashion in the 90s where we used to say, oh, you know, I don't mind you, it's just the rest of them. But you don't know the rest of them. So what you mean is the black person that you know is cool, but the rest that you don't know, you still just make assumptions about. And so I think getting to know people, I think organising, you know, I think working on yourself, I think trying to be a better person yourself is something I always work on, trying to make better decisions, to consume less alcohol, to fight less. You know, when I was younger, I used to get drunk and get in fights and whatever else, and you know, you try and change. So I think it's a process of internal and external improvement of yourself and trying to make as productive a contribution to human society as you can. Find a young person and mentor them. Teach them life skills, you know, particularly if they don't have someone in their life that does that. Find five people if you have that time. Contribute to financially if you can. You know, there are a number of ways in which people can try and make the world a little bit more livable for themselves and for others.
Kids. I was just going to finish on kids.
Yeah.
Are they a big part of that?
Yeah, I don't have any yet, but... But
I'm, generally, right?
I'm planning
the next generations are going to be the ones that really, well, one, face massive climate change, and deal with probably the aftermath or the breakdown of sort of this Western white supremacist being at the top.
Well, who knows? I don't believe that Western society is suddenly going to collapse. I don't believe that. I believe that for people who define their Western identity as having kind of unparalleled power to do basically whatever you want, for those people, it's a crisis. I don't think New Zealand is suddenly going to become a poor society, or even Britain. It's a wealthy, stable, prosperous society. But if you define your identity by other people being poor, so the moment that Nigeria or India or Ghana or Vietnam attain Western living standards, you suddenly feel threatened by that. Not inspired by other people's success, but threatened by it, because you've defined your identity vis-a-vis the supposed inferiority of others. That's the sense in which the decline of the West is a problem for people. But I don't think Western society is going to sort of, or needs to, necessarily collapse in the sense that people mean it. It just might not be as dominant as it used to be. But for people who've determined their identity via dominance, that feels like collapse.
Okay, I've forgotten a question. Is it all right if I
go
back? I'm sorry, man. I just wanted to, your chapter on Castro and Cuba, and then looking at Mandela. that idea that the US sort of reframed their definition of liberty and freedom when it was sort of best for them, or however you want to say it. So after the war against fascism with the face of the Nazi, and then it came to apartheid in South Africa, which was the regime based on the same genocidal ideas.
Yeah.
Not only did they do nothing to stop it, but they supported it. So yeah, that idea of just...
Precisely. The war against the Nazis was not a war against white supremacy. It was a war against the Nazis. And for lots of people who participated in that war, it might have been a war against fascism ideologically. For the Soviets, they would argue that it was a war against fascism ideologically. For maybe even the Brits, they would argue it was a war against fascism ideologically because of British liberalism. But British liberalism was not incompatible with white supremacy. The colonization of Africa was justified in largely liberal humanitarian terms. For example, so it's no surprise that Britain and the United States continued to support apartheid South Africa long after this supposed war against fascism. I mean, it was 20 years after the end of World War II before black Americans even got the right to vote in a country they'd fought and bled for several times. So clearly, fighting the Nazis was not incompatible with maintaining white supremacy at home. That just is what it is. And I think the contribution of Cuba to decolonization in Africa and to apartheid has been ignored for precisely that reason, because you know the evil commies in this case were actually made a positive contribution to the forward march of human rights.
Yes. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
No, thank you. Pleasure.
Really appreciate it.
No, thank you.